Welcome to this episode of Not Your Father Stocks. I'm here with Tyler, and today we're going to talk a little bit about turning over rocks. This was kind of, it's an obvious thing to most people, but the quote was kind of made famous by Peter Lynch. He said that the person that turns over the most rocks wins the game, and that's always been his philosophy. And I don't think there's really any way to go about disagreeing with that, Tyler. I don't think it's possible, right?
Yeah, no. And turning over a lot of rocks is, you know, going to give you a massive advantage compared to, you know, your peer that maybe is not turning over a lot of rocks. I mean, simply because the person that turns over the most rocks has kind of the largest library of opportunity to kind of allocate to. So it seems, you know, reasonable that that idea of turning over the most rocks, you know, kind of results in being a long-term winner. So I like that idea and I like that quote.
I think that it provides you with a lot of case studies, because if you actually dive in and understand, I know Connor Haley talked about this on the last podcast I heard him on, how he printed out a bunch of stock pitches, the best ones and I think the worst ones from Value Investors Club, and just read through all of those before, I think he was in high school when he did that, but it allowed him to build a lot of case studies. And then something else, it does build case studies, but it's also pattern recognition. And it's something that I'm really starting to develop. I'm only into my fourth year. Tyler has a lot of experience on me, but I'm already starting to get pattern recognition. And I feel like that's probably a lot stronger and better for you at this point in your career.
Yeah. And I've never really thought of it that way as pattern recognition, but I'd also listened to that podcast with Haley, and, you know, I love his approach to investing. I think it's phenomenal. I love the way he thinks. And I think the way he is approaching investing, you know, is really testament as to how far he's gone. And, you know, I think his upside potential is a lot higher than most investors, purely because I think he's thinking the right way. And I've listened to some other investors kind of like in that league, that caliber that he's kind of in. And, you know, I prefer to approach investing a lot more similar to him compared to some of the other guys I've listened to.
It's the process he has is simple and a bit complex at the same time, because obviously him being a Harvard guy, and he was inspired. He talks about it a lot. He was inspired by Joel Greenblatt. And Joel Greenblatt, if you watch some of his Columbia Business School lectures, he talks a lot about special situations and kind of digging into companies that are a lot harder to understand and hard to value, which is something that I have in the past kind of shied away from, but I'm getting into better now that I'm better understanding the capital structure of the business, basically what drives share price, what drives earnings, just the overall drivers of the company.
Yeah, and I kind of think a little bit differently than them in that sense of, you know, process is similar. I feel like my processes are somewhat similar to Haley's. And I haven't studied Greenblatt, and I know I've heard so many great things about him, but I've never, you know, kind of dived into his content myself. But when it goes from process to simple, and then they kind of go into these complex valuations, I'm a lot different there, where I'm looking for, you know, valuations that are blatantly easy. But I'm also on the short side, where these guys are really trying to pour in a lot of money for a long-term investment, you know, a 4 to 5 year investment. And I'm, you know, kind of approaching I have a similar process, but I'm playing the opposite side. And I'm really looking for stocks that are going to, you know, realize the value in a relatively short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Greenblatt, I don't know if it's Gotham now, if it was Gotham, or they're both Gotham Capital Management, but I think it was from, I want to say 1985 to 1995, a 10-year run like that. He did 50% after hedge fund fees. I'm pretty sure he was probably running a 2-20 split there. And he said he did it by, we talk about this a lot, being super concentrated, and how Buffett said it before, diversification is like de-risking ignorance. I totally butchered that quote, but...
Well, yeah, and I was kind of thinking about diversification the other day, and I mean, not to be too harsh, but, you know, literally any idiot can diversify effectively. There's no thinking involved. It's, And I think it's actually, I think it's ignorant to risk. Diversification and what I perceive as risk are, it's just not how you avoid risk. And it's not, I don't think it's actually how you take risk. I think risk taking is a really important part of investing that a lot of people discount. It's not just about buying companies under value. It's about buying companies under value with a reasonable risk measure compared to reward. And, you know, I think that's discounted a lot in modern day investing. And I see it happen quite a bit in the companies that I watch people buy, or even, you know, companies that I read on Seeking Alpha, where you have a guy that's poured hours and hours of research, you know, trying to value the asset, but he's kind of discounting, you know, what can go wrong. And, you know, in business, businesses don't last forever. And, you know, a stub toe can lead to, you know, a lot more downside than people are expecting when they are kind of pouring money into a under what they think is undervalued.
Yeah, I'm always thinking that. I'm never really, I know you have a more deep value playbook than I do, but for my strategy, I don't really buy something just because I think it's undervalued. I would have to see like 3 times upside on a DCF basis probably for me to buy it. But I need something that's undervalued with a catalyst, something that can recognize the true value of the business, whether that's going to be a new product expansion, a partnership, a merger, special situations, anything like that. Like, there needs to be something that allows you to unlock the value, because there's so many dead value traps out there. We've covered a lot of them in the Elite Investor. Sri, by the way, Sri has an awesome podcast called Market Champions. I just want to chime him in there quick, but he's uncovered a lot of deep value plays that haven't had anything to unlock the potential. Obviously, he was dove deep into Kodak pre whatever. I didn't even follow it. What happened there? But I think that's a risk. I'm ignorant to deep value plays, obviously, but that, I think that would be an obvious risk for me going into a play like that.
What exactly? The Kodak?
Not just Kodak, but if I just deem something as an inferior business, the demand is obviously falling. Out of the company, revenues are declining, margins are declining, but they're, it's like, because I'm telling you, I'm ignorant to this, the net asset value or whatever Graham goes into, if it's trading below its net asset value, it's not really my play. I completely understand the play and why someone would make that, or why you make it. I follow your plays like that too, but it's just not for me, because I don't necessarily see a catalyst in play to make that value be recognized, or why someone would want to acquire it at that asset value, a dying business or inferior business.
Well, and, you know, I think that's where, you know, a lot of reverse mergers happen for that reason, where you have a asset that is listed. Being listed is in some cases valuable to businesses that may need capital. So there are reverse mergers to unlock value in a, and obviously when we're sitting at a table and we own the business, and let's say we have $200 million cash, we're not going to do a deal for under that cash value. So when you do find situations like that, it is more so like a special situation type event where you are playing a reverse merger. And, you know, you have to weigh how likely it is. You know, is management going to buy back shares? Is management going to maybe issue a special dividend? You know, these things do happen. They're very real catalysts that you should be weighing in or even considering. But yeah, there are companies like probably at MSN that is trading super cheap to its, you know, value found on the balance sheet, but it has a dying business and it does not seem like the management team is, you know, interested in unlocking this value for shareholders. They probably just want to get paid for the, you know, the lifetime of this business. They have a ton of capital. So it is, and, you know, it's part of investing where you do have to think about the situation. And that's another thing that I kind of do a lot, is I like to just grade the overall setup and like weigh all these, think about these different factors and then kind of weigh them. You know, it's a guess, but sometimes you can see trends or pattern recognition in that, you know, I like to usually, when I go through my my research process, I'm thinking about the whole business, you know, from the seat of the CEO. And I'm saying, you know, I'm circling the areas that I would be concerned about. And usually, you know, it's always the cash position. It's always, you know, the same things over and over. Okay, we don't have any revenues, or, you know, our product is not really that great. We have negative reviews. All these things are super, super important in understanding the entire business. And then you kind of think, you know, okay, where is this business in a 9-inning game? Are they in inning 2 or are they in inning 8 and, you know, dunzo? So that's kind of another thing where people are always, you know, there is no one system that works. It is more of like valuation is an art. You really need to think about the business, what the product is, what the industry is doing. And, you know, where do we stand? Is the business healthy? Is it unhealthy? You know, does the management team want to retire? Are they old? Are they young? And all these things matter. So that's why a lot of people, when they kind of say, well, we should make a formula or something like that, you kind of need to weigh different parts of different businesses, mm-hmm. because every situation is, you know, incredibly different.
Yeah, I want to touch back on what you said about MSN, how management probably just kind of wants to milk it out and keep making money from it. And that right there just screams to me to check into the management incentives. There were two plays I've been involved in recently that the management incentives were like a huge thesis for the play. One is shout out to my buddy Florian for giving me this play, if you're listening, Summer, S-U-M-R. A CEO came in from a restructuring firm. Incentives aligned to sell the company at a certain price. He gets this amount of money. His firm gets this amount of money. Then Waiter, WTRH, CEO came in, cleaned up the company, fixed the balance sheet, got the debt interest rate lowered, and his incentives were aligned for basically with the restricted stock units, the RSUs, almost $10 million. Every single dollar that the share price goes up, he's going to make an extra $10 million if the company's sold. So those incentives, in turn, Waiter, he is also a shareholder, so his incentives are aligned with me. He wants to get the highest takeout price possible. Summer, he wants to get the highest takeout price possible as well because he makes more money, his firm makes more money, the shareholders make more money. And I think incentives are, especially down here, investing in small microcaps, I feel like it's a more authentic investing experience where you're not just totally buying into stories. You actually have to do this level of work.
Yeah.
What do you think, Tyler?
So I think incentives drive the world. I think incentives are incredibly important, not just in investing, but, you know, everyday life. If you can offer someone incentive to do something, you know, if the reward is high enough for them, they will, you know, in fact, do it. And, you know, I think we see people, you know, take incentives to the next level. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, if you are an investor, I mean, you should always look for a management team that is going to, you know, that is focused on creating as much shareholder value as possible. And unfortunately, that is not always the case. So when you do find, you know, particular circumstances where that is the case, you know, those are really the businesses you want to be invested in for the long term. But yeah, I think you have two pretty good opportunities there in finding those situations where you have CEOs that want to win or are going to win if the share price goes higher or the buyout price is, you know, increased.
Yeah, when you see the amount of money that they're going to make by this, you know that that's what they're working towards every single day. And have you ever read anything from Nassim Taleb?
Yep.
I didn't read all of Skin in the Game, but I breezed through Skin in the Game, and it's basically a huge portion of it's talking about incentives. And it's funny, or it's not funny, but he calls politicians interventionistas, where they sit in a cushy office and are guaranteed their government paycheck, air-conditioned offices, and they make decisions for war, whatever it might be, in foreign countries where they never feel the effect because they have no skin in the game. And that's completely relatable to what we were talking about with MSN and those two positions that I covered, or just overall any CEO that you want. Like, I'm very hesitant to invest into a company where the CEO doesn't have incentives aligned with me. He doesn't own the stock, or if he doesn't even have a material position of his net worth into the company, it kind of rubs me the wrong way. It's not always bad, but it's a lot nicer. If you're investing into a hedge fund, wouldn't it be nice if the hedge fund manager also had his money invested with you and just wasn't collecting fees off you? It's the same concept.
Yeah, definitely. And it's super important. Now, there are times where I've seen businesses with low insider ownership with management teams that kind of do the right thing. And that's another thing that I was thinking about the other day is, you know, if the management team, if the stock gets extremely cheap and the management team has no interest in buying the stock, it's likely cheap for a really good reason. And I don't know why. I've just been kind of noticing people saying, oh, this business is really cheap. But when you look at the industry and kind of what may be ahead, if management teams aren't buying these extremely low valuations, you know, they're probably in the seats to know what the future looks like in their respected industries. And if they're kind of sitting on their hands still, I don't see any, you know, reason to really be aggressive and jump in early.
Yeah, if they don't think it's a good price to buy, then why is it a good price for you?
Yeah,
obviously. I mean, you also, there's so many reasons that when it comes to like insider selling, I don't weigh a huge emphasis on it unless they're like clearing out their entire position, because insider buying, I feel like there's only one incentive if you buy, that's to make money, right? There's literally, I don't know if there's anything else, but there's tons of reasons that people sell. I forget who it was on Twitter, but they posted a excerpt of a book they were reading. Someone had a meeting with the CEO and asked him about why he was selling some of his position. And he talked about, I'm here to get rich and make money. And my wife wanted a beach house and I wanted a beach house. So I sold some and got a beach house and I'm still here to make more money. So like there's tons of reasons. Someone was in a car accident, one of their family members, they got a divorce. Like I think there's so many reasons to sell. So it's hard to speculate on insider selling, but speculating on insider buying, I think seems easier to me because there's only one reason to make money, unless you can think of something else, but I thought about it a lot and I think it's only to make money.
Well, I think it's definitely usually to make money. I can't think of any other reasons to, buy stock, but I'm guessing there might be another one out there. But let's be real, 95% of the time, at least, it's to make money. So, yeah, and I like that too. There's no real need to speculate. People do things with their money. If the CEO has $40 million worth of stock and he wants to sell, you know, a quarter of it, who gives? You know, he hopefully earned it. I don't necessarily mind when I see insider sales. It doesn't bother me a ton. Now, if the stock is super cheap and they don't really own a ton and they're still selling it, maybe. But usually I don't see that happening too much.
So we kind of got off the topic of turning rocks, but I think we've been turning rocks this entire time. We just talked about multiple case studies that we've had in pattern recognition across insider buys and insider sells. So if you're still listening, I think this is still on topic.
Yeah. And there's all kinds of patterns that I notice. That's kind of part of the game and that's kind of how you build strategies. And that's, you know, why I, you know, dig through the biotechs that, you know, have failed drugs, because the reverse merger is a pattern, right? That's a very likely way to unlock the shareholder value. And I've seen it play out, you know, the right way enough times where I, you know, now built that into a basic strategy. And I don't think enough people think like that in terms of investing. You know, you should really be building, you know, strategies that, you know, can net alpha for you. And, you know, once you test them enough and you play with them enough, you know, you have legitimate investing strategies that you can implement. And then that's really where I think the rock turning comes in. So, you know, I have multiple investing strategies where if I'm really doing great on my bread and butter strategy, those are the rocks that I'm playing the most. I think it's super beneficial. And then, you know, obviously I talk about having a playbook where it's like, you know, short selling extremely overvalued, worthless trash is my number one play. That's my go-to. When I'm finding plenty of opportunities with that strategy, I'm not even looking at, you know, biotechs that have failed drugs. You know, I'm only looking at biotechs with failed drugs when, you know, plays number one and two are, you know, dry. There's no life in them. Then I'm, you know, searching for, okay, what might happen in the next 6 months that's going to, you know, make me money in my portfolio. Okay, let me go out and, you know, dig through a bunch of biotechs, see if any of them have failed drugs or, you know, maybe have a failed drug coming in the future. And I know a lot of people want to see these drugs get approved and stuff, but fact of the matter is they don't. And it is pretty hard to bring a drug to market. And these companies raise tons of cash. So usually they have very healthy balance sheets if the timing's right. And, you know, that drug failure, those businesses end up getting pummeled. Those are the stocks that you see that are down, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80%. And, you know, people naturally will overreact and they will sell stocks under value. And if it's selling under liquidation value, it's really hard to lose if you're buying an asset under its liquidation value. Like, that is the best strategy out there. And it could take 6, 8, 12 months to unlock the value. But if there is enough value, you know, to your risk, it's a worthy position to take for your portfolio, like most of the time.
Yeah, that's where Seth Klarman talks about a catalyst too, because he plays a lot of deep value, and apparently over his career he's been stuck a little while, so he likes to see a catalyst to realize that value as soon as possible. That's something that I've been moving into more recently. I'm not a macro guy; I'm a strict bottoms up guy, but I do zoom out. So generally, I run through the company bottoms up, zoom out to the industry. What's the industry doing? Then zoom out a little bit to the macro, which I don't pay a ton of attention to, because when I find value, I find value. But lately I've been looking into more special situations, stuff like the stocks that I did just previously talk about, because I just don't want to. I have positions, I have deep DCF value plays that I'm trying to run these special situations that don't need me to have exposure for a long period of time, so I can roll those profits into my value plays. And again, value and growth, we've talked about this before, tied at the hip. So when I talk about value, I'm not talking about strictly like deep the net asset value, but growth as well. You guys know the kind of companies that I follow by now.
Yeah. And that's another thing that kind of always bothers me is, like, you know, growth is part of basically every valuation. And the lack of growth is part of valuation as well. So
that makes it so hard.
Can make it hard.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a good point. And that kind of brings me back to the what we talked about before the show, is that, you know, what is your definition of investing? And for someone like me, you know, who does play, you know, both sides of the field, I really think that investing is, you know, simply you know, the game of realizing value. So if, you know, I look at a business and it is worth $30 million and I see it trading at $60 million. Investing is, you know, putting together a plan of attack or a plan of risk management where I'm in position to realize the difference between that $60 million and $30 million valuation, you know, that the market is offering and I am giving the business. And, you know, developing strategies of risk management are really, really important. And I see people make it a little bit more complex than I think it needs to be. But, you know, it could be something as simple as, you know, focusing on one really great opportunity and ignoring the other opportunities, kind of going back into the idea that it takes no intelligence whatsoever to diversify. You know, you can have 100 stocks in your portfolio. You're diversifying. Like, you're not doing anything. You're basically, you know, you're doing it wrong. You're ruining your portfolio by doing that. If you concentrate on one really, really good idea, you're not only, you know, completely capturing the upside of that opportunity, but you also fully understand the downside of that opportunity. And I think that's extremely important to the psychology of investing. Understanding your risk is super, super important.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's part of the reason that I'm busting into these special situations is that I want to grow my portfolio to a point where I could basically load a massive position into SMSI, honestly. Tyler, I don't know if you've seen some of my most recent updates and some things that we've found and uncovered, but I don't want to share them on here right now. Remind me to tell you after we get off here. But that just goes into the concentrated investing. And I did find that Buffett quote. It was diversification is, I closed a tab, but it's something against ignorance. And I think there's actually, one time I mentioned a stock to a friend that I thought had extremely low downside risk and high upside risk, or not, you know what I'm saying, low downside risk. And I pitched it to him. He's like, no, I'm just trying to be safe and diversify. And I just let it, the conversation in there, but I wanted to be like, what is your definition of risk? When I see a business with extremely, extremely limited downside and massive potential upside, I mean, that's my definition of risk right there. Buying the S&P 500 ETF is more risky to me than finding a play like that where management incentives were aligned. All the stuff we previously talked about were aligned and they were there and it did play out.
I run into this problem, you know, all the time as well, where, you know, for me and you, because we are able to think about risk a little bit differently. And I want to say that I think the way that we approach risk is, you know, the exact right way to approach it. And I want to lean on, you know, the game of poker here to kind of teach us about risk. And, you know, fact is a lot of these people that we talk to, that we run into, that we, you know, that want to talk about investing, if they don't understand the idea of risk or what risk is and how it plays a role in your investing, you literally cannot have a, you know, a beneficial conversation. And to me, a lot of these investors are, you know, in a sense, just ignorant to the game. And that is going to be dangerous for them in the long run. And hopefully, you know, advantage our side for, you know, taking the time to think about these things and, you know, practice them.
Yeah, I guess it's two different mental models, I guess you could say, to think about risk. But I guess it's different. What I was going to say was that we aren't popular guys at parties to talk about. Like, as soon as, you know, I feel like you've probably experienced this too. Someone asks you a question and about where the market's going or what you think of the market. And you're like, I don't really know about that, but I do know about this and how this, like how this small company that they've never heard of can do this and that, or this is stupid, whatever it is. Yeah. And as soon as you like open your mouth and say like you're five words deep, it just like you've already lost their attention. And I mean, it's rare. That's why the internet and having a community like Augury is so valuable to me personally. I mean, a lot of these guys are my best friends at this point. Now I talk to them more than I talk to anybody else, and they actually get what I'm trying to do. They're goal oriented, system process oriented. And yeah, I love having this group. I know that's kind of off topic, but
no, and I honestly, I couldn't agree more. And I literally love the guys that we have in our group so much because, you know, they actually care. They're actually here to win. Like, they're not just fools. And kind of what you were saying, you know, so you're kind of saying what? It's not popular to say Uber's trash in front of, you know, a crowd of, you know, 7-8 people and 90% of them own Uber. And, you know, it's like, as soon as I say that, obviously everyone's like, okay, well, this kid's an asshole. You know, I own, you know, Uber. It's a great company, but they don't understand what they're doing with their money. They don't understand what they're doing with their portfolio. And you can't have a, you know, a conversation trying to understand your ideas of risk to people that don't want to learn them or don't want to think differently about how they're investing their capital, because this is how they were taught. And when you kind of invade on that idea that they think that they understand, well, they're like defense goes up and they now feel threatened. And usually the conversation isn't that great. So that's why I kind of am learning just to keep my ideas to myself. And frankly, if I'm, you know, invested heavily in ICCC, and I might want to tell some of my friends about it, but I can't get my friends to, you know, maybe try this idea of, you know, how I play the game. And, you know, and unfortunately, hopefully, you know, I get lucky, and hopefully, you know, I don't wish anything bad for them, but hopefully, you know, in over the next 10, 20 years, I can really separate my portfolio performances, you know, from theirs. And I know, I want to say I'm pretty confident in my short selling ability, which that in itself probably offers a massive edge to, you know, my portfolio performance compared to my peers, in the sense that they really have no clue how to, you know, protect themselves against a down market, or even understand how to short sell. So, you know, you can't really coach anyone on how to manage their portfolio. They're going to do what they want. Some players are uncoachable, and, you know, they don't have great careers like the coachable players, or the players that actually, you know, take the time to keep their bodies healthy, kind of like a LeBron James. I mean, this guy's got, you know, had so much hype going into the league, and he's done nothing but keep his body in tip-top, absolutely immaculate shape for all these years. It's truly incredible. Like, the guy was born to be the best basketball player of all time, and he's executed his plan of attack, you know, flawlessly. And it's, you know, that's how I want to approach, you know, investing, and how I want to, you know, keep my portfolio healthy, is like, you know, I truly care what goes into this thing. I'm not out here, you know, messing around trying to catch Uber when it becomes a $1 trillion company, or Tesla. Like, there's just too much risk. And if you make the good decision after good decision in terms of risk to reward, you should get paid appropriately, you know, as, you know, compounding takes place.
Yeah, I have a wrestling background, and it taught me a lot. Wrestling is a super tough sport. I feel like you can learn the principles in other sports, but something like MMA and wrestling, I feel like, is a little bit different. Resilience and attitude and the discipline that takes to make weight every single match, every single tournament, all season. And then the resilience you develop of, relate this back to stocks, is getting crushed in a position that you had high conviction in, or whatever it is, how you took a loss. When you step out there on the mat, it's literally you out there. It's just you. There's nobody there to do anything, to take any pressure off of you. It's just you. And you have kids that bust your face into the mat, and they basically murder you out there in front of an entire gym. And you have to stand up, shake their hand, look them in the eye, walk off the mat. And that just taught me so much resilience. And then it applies to this: when I do take a loss, when I am wrong about something, it's just going back to the wrestling room and learning what went wrong, watching the tape of what I did. Same thing here, reflecting on a post-mortem thesis is something I do, a pre-mortem and a post-mortem thesis. Like, after I sell a position I was pretty heavily into, I take the time to, like, write a couple of paragraphs about why I think it went right, why I think it went wrong, if I was lucky that something happened. It's the same thing as sports in general. So, I mean, I'm not a huge sports guy anymore. I don't watch any sports. The only thing I watch is wrestling. But you can relate this. If you are a sports guy, you can relate it so easy. I do it all the time. Tyler does it all the time with baseball. And I'm sure there's plenty of other examples out there of people.
Yeah, and I really like that idea of, you know, what you were saying about wrestling. You know, once you get your face beat down into the mat, you know, you have to, you know, stand back up, shake the guy's hand, and, you know, that's very real in investing. But, you know, my problem is sometimes people are so scared to get their face beat down in the mat that they, you know, blindly invest in other people's ideas, S&P 500, whatever it may be. And, you know, you can't be afraid to lose. You can't be afraid to win. And I always say you can't be afraid to win big, but you most certainly can't, you know, lose on a position, or lose on an idea, or think wrong about an idea and, you know, really dwell on it too much. It's literally, I have above my I go through like the entire process of that I've made for myself, where it's like I do all my fundamental research. I see who's holding the stock, who's, you know, an ally to me, who's, you know, a threat to my position, where everything kind of lies. And then I measure my bet. And then once I place the bet, and the whole position plays out, I either win or lose. And I have, you know, these little trays kind of set up on my wall here. When I submit that position, once I'm out of it, right above my trays, it just says on to the next. And no matter win or lose, you know, the game never stops. And for me, this game is nothing more than, you know, waking up every day and finding a mispriced bet. And that's really all I do. And it's nice to be able to lose on a stock and not dwell about the position. And that's something that I've really focused on for myself after, you know, the last couple of years, and even having some really big winners like a tandem, where it's like, don't dwell on what you did wrong, but note, reflect on what you could have done better and aim to apply it when that situation occurs again. And if you kind of think about investing like that and you kind of approach it that way, you know, you find where you can get better and you don't beat yourself up because you went 0-for-3 with 3 strikeouts. You know, you got another game tomorrow. The stock market is always open the next day. So, you know, I think that's, you know, super important. You know, you're going to have losers and you're going to have huge winners. You can't really dwell on both, but, you know, notice, reflect on things that are super important to why that position worked or why that position didn't work. Circle them, you know, write about them, actually think about them. And I think you'll build, you know, kind of an investing shield that becomes almost indestructible.
Okay. I think we pretty much covered everything we wanted to there. And I should have said that I agree with everything completely that you just said before I tried to end it on you. But that was really well put and completely agree. To close this out, guys, I want to say I'm going to put my email in the description. So if any of you guys listening want to hear us talk about anything particular, if you have any questions regarding companies that we discussed, just anything in general about Augury, let me know. Send me an email. I'm also, in the coming months, I'm hoping to build out a course. It's not going to be super complex. It's going to be more targeted towards beginners, understanding what drives a business, what are the movers, the drivers, capital structure of a business, nothing too intense. But if you guys would like to see anything in that, send me an email. I'd love to hear.
Sweet. And I just wanted to add, I'm going to be going on to Sri's podcast later this week. So if you do listen to this full episode and you want to hear the conversation that I'm going to be having with Sri, make sure you check out his podcast, Market Champions, and we'll see if we can link that in the podcast description as well.
Will do. All right. Catch you guys next time.
Peace.